Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world with the guts to say Shohei Ohtani is underrated. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and why would we say something so brave yet so true?
Wow, yeah, such courage. I'm glad somebody is finally saying it. We are using our platform for good, and that is going to be one of the topics on today's episode. We are going to talk about the Angels in a positive light, at least somewhat. We're going to talk about Ronald Acuña Jr. That's easy to talk about in a positive light. He is absolutely amazing. We are going to bring on our friend Daniel Alvarez to talk about the Miami Marlins, who are legitimately good at baseball, and of course, Luis Arraez and his magic. And then later on, as we continue our mid-season look as teams cross the 81-game mark, we are going to look back at MLB.com's bold predictions made by many of our friends on the beats and see how they are doing so far. Still time, still a whole half season for these bold predictions to come true or become very false, but we are going to get into all of that. But Jake, are we going to begin with Shohei Ohtani? That seems like a fair thing to do.
We are, but before we begin, just a reminder to rate and review the show on iTunes, Spotify, the record player that you listen to in your living room. It really helps the show grow. We want as many people to listen to it as possible so that, you know, the human race can learn about the wonder that is Shohei Ohtani. Last night, Shohei Ohtani, a member of the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, struck out 10 and hit two home runs in the same game.
We have talked
on this show, Jordan, many times about how because he does this every night, or I guess once every five nights, it numbs us. We are used to the greatness. But last night was a really, like, I watched this whole game. I sat down and I consumed it in its entirety. And for the Angels to emerge victorious in a Shohei Ohtani stunner in which Mike Trout did not even play, is this a turning point for the franchise? They have won a Tungsten O'Doyle game.
Well, no, it can't be a Tungsten O'Doyle game if Mike Trout didn't play.
It's just a Tungsten game.
Yeah, like we gotta, it would only really work if, I understand what we're getting at here. We are going to give the Angels some credit, but I think, I mean, this was a game where Mike Moustakas was batting cleanup and had two hits. So that, you know, to be able to win that game, I know the White Sox are a mess and they continue to be, but the Angels have won enough of these games where Ohtani and Trout have done amazing things where we have had to reconsider their place this season. I do not want to extend this conversation to Ohtani's future because I think that is foolish. I think this has nothing to do. There's nothing the Angels could do that are going to get him. It doesn't matter. So let's ignore that conversation. All this
just
is
quickly,
about.
Just quickly, I believe that maybe this is oversimplifying things. I think the Dodgers are going to give Shohei the most money and it is going to be very boring and we're not going to spend a whole lot of time thinking about it. And instead, I would like to focus on the here and now, on the wonderful things he's doing on the field and not what it means for his future.
Yeah, right. Well, I won't even comment on the Dodgers part or how interesting that I am looking forward to the free agency. Let's be very clear. But that's not how we don't need to be talking about this because the point is he's still on the team now. And as long as he's still on the team, as long as the best baseball player and maybe the second best baseball player, or at least one of the top five, is still on the team. I know Mike Trout hasn't played that way. They have the opportunity to win something significant. They have not at all. They have not even had a winning season. But this year, they've done enough to convince, I think, both of us that for this year, they are clearly in the mix. Now, correct. Before we get to the Angels at large, I want to focus here on this game from Ohtani and how we react to stuff like this. Because to your point, are we numb to it? Maybe. I will say, I think I've made this point on the show in years past. I don't particularly, and this is with all love in the world for Sarah Langs and researchers of her ilk, of which there are none because she is the best. The fun facts about him, I don't particularly care for anymore. Telling me that he's the first player to do X, Y since this. Now, last night was fun because we got to see CeCe Sabathia hitting home runs. In a clip that was a first time he's done X since CeCe, like that was cool. But in general, coming up with all these newfangled ways to describe how it's the first time he's due, unnecessary. Watch the guy play baseball, and it's unbelievable. He has the most homers, and he is the hardest pitcher to get a hit against. Just watch him, and you know he's the best baseball player. It's so, so, so special.
I would say you're allowed to do Shohei fun facts, but only on each side of his game.
So yes, those, like, yes.
Shohei as a hitter and Shohei as a pitcher can be separate fun facts. But when you do them together, it's like, no one's done this since Babe Ruth. We know. We get it. It's incredible. Oh, my God. I actually think that separating the two even emphasizes and amplifies more how incredible he is.
Totally. And if you want to do I'm a fan of the he's leading the league in home runs. He has the most X number of 450-foot homers, blah, 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 blah. And then you just throw in, oh, yeah, he also pitches. Like, that's fun. I'll do the version of that, right? But, like, coming up with explaining the specific accomplishments of doing both at the same time, yes, he's the only person doing it, and we should not be taking it for granted ever, right? But he is, I mean, honestly, and I think we've talked about this before, which side is more impressive to you at this stage, regardless of whether they're happening at the same time? Because I, especially this year, he had a stretch where he looked terrible at the end of May offensively, but like the home runs that he's hitting every which way, I just don't even, he's hitting home runs. It's not just the distance. It's the way, the second one last night, it was the best pitch of the world off Tukey, but that he's just basically kind of flicking it out to left center is just unfathomable. Again, we're talking about a guy who, if he was not a pitcher, he would be one of the three most exhilarating position players, even though he's not playing a position.
So I'm going to do a little baseball explaining here.
Oh.
I want you to think about Luis Arraez, and I want you to think about Joey Gallo. Mm-hmm. When a hitter swings with a lot of force and rotational power, like a Joey Gallo, they tend to have struggles adjusting to pitches in different parts of the strike zone. Mm-hmm. And this is understandable, right? The faster you're moving forward, the more power you're moving with forward, the harder it is to move your hands to where they need to be. Take that and compare it to Luis Arraez, who is not rotating with any force, but is able to get his bat to the ball all the time. Otani's ability to adjust to pitches in the strike zone in different spots and maintain his body forward and keep his hands back is one of a kind. I mean, peak Harper is similar to this, right? Where he can go get pitches in different parts. But if you compare him to Mike Trout, like Mike Trout still always and will always have like a hole in the top of the zone where he just cannot always get to those pitches, right? He's a low ball hitter. Otani is a ball hitter. You know, he's able to go get pitches in various parts and do crazy things with them, like the second homer he hit last night. I just want to read out the stats for this month, if I may.
Please. Oh, yeah.
This month, the month of June, which is almost over, 3.26 ERA, 37 strikeouts, okay, in 30 innings. Pretty good. Very good. Otani the hitter, 3.83, 4.73, 9.15. With 13 homers, 7 doubles,
He's slugging 900 in June?
Correct.
Okay. That's amazing. It does. I mean, it sure has felt that way. And by the way, that line is with a 1-for-7 in Coors Field. Remember. Mm. Right? Like, that is like probably another 8 to 10 total bases that he missed out on just by letting his friends have all the fun.
So, an article from Rhett Bollinger at MLB.com about Otani's amazing night yesterday. Something that stuck out to me is the quotes in here from people around Otani. So Otani does something amazing and all the reporters go down there and they're like, how about the Otani guy? What are they supposed to say at this point, right? If you're Phil Nevin or Chad Wallach, I just want to read these quotes. It's a wow factor, Phil Nevin said. We're seeing things every day that we've never seen before. You try not to take it for granted. I don't think any of us do. I understand how special it is, but I understand how special the person is to our room and what he brings to us every single day. Love that. Every game somehow seems to get crazier the more I watch him play, said catcher Chad Wallach.
That's
watching
a good
him
quote.
Pitch like that.
That's a good quote.
Like and then that. Go hit two home runs. Somehow it still surprises you every time. I love that, right? Because like if you're catching Otani, it's like, wow, that was a good inning. And you're so used to as a catcher, right? seeing your pitcher there on the bench, and you can go talk to him and talk strategy. And then you're Chad Wallach and you look on the field and there's the guy pitching, hitting a home run twice.
And to that point, that's why when the fun fact, and by the way, like, it's not like I don't want Sarah Langs to keep giving me the fun fact. It's just like, those are the things that are washing over me. Those are the, those that are making me numb to it. But the elements of the both ways that will never, ever get old is on games like last night when he homers and has to basically eschew the celebration because he has to get ready to pitch again. And yeah. I've talked about the other version of it too, where, right, he comes in, you know, after throwing 110 pitches, comes in the seventh, and he's like clearly wiped, and he straps on the arm guard because, like, I got to score some runs for this goddamn team. And that's the thing. Like, we are watching this guy win baseball games by himself. There is nobody else that can do it like this in a way. Like, sure, you got, oh, he's carrying, this guy's Aaron Judge. Okay, great, right? But no, that's as amazing as Aaron Judge is, the Yankees still have a very good pitching staff that generally keeps them in the ballgame, whatever. Ohtani is winning games by himself regularly in ways that's just like, it shouldn't be possible. And yes, we shouldn't take it for granted, but I do think it is important because we can't get enough to it to kind of zoom in on the very individual moments in each performance, individual swing, individual pitch or sequence that he does, because that's how we can really appreciate it on a regular basis.
And last night he gets taken out with a cracked fingernail after 102 pitches, I believe. Mm-hmm. In the seventh inning. So he comes out as a pitcher and then homers in the bottom of the inning, right? That is a great example because when he homers and he's pitching, he doesn't always throw the helmet on, like, mm-hmm. the celebration, mm-hmm. Japanese, like, I can't remember the name of it. Mm-hmm. He doesn't really throw it on, but then he comes out of the game, homers in the bottom of the seventh, and then puts it on. And it's like, oh, right, he's out of the game as a pitcher. That's how you know. One last quote about this, Jordan, from White Sox manager Pedro Grifol. Quote, he's extremely talented.
Yeah, I would say that's not wrong, Pedro. Yeah. And also, like, again, if we extend this a little bit to just the Angels, like, I am still, again, like, I don't want to make this about the future because, if anything, he's not going anywhere. They're not going to trade him. He's going to be there and they deserve to ride it out. And they've built a good enough team where they are going to be in the mix. And honestly, as I just mentioned, like, this guy can win games on his own. Like, at some point, that's probably what it's gonna take. And that's what I'm so excited for the second half of the season. Once we get past the trade deadline, and hopefully we don't have to talk about, like, of course we're gonna wonder where his future is, but, like, once we get past the trade deadline, it will literally be about, okay, Ohtani is clearly on a mission, not just to make $600-700 million, whatever. But he's on a mission to play on a winning baseball team, and he's doing everything that he can to ensure that that is the case. And every win counts in a very significant way, especially for an Angels team that frequently loses games in very stupid ways. He knows how important every game is, and he's just going out and doing everything he possibly can. And that is going to be amazing to watch down the stretch, no matter when the Angels season ends.
I've been labeled an Angels hater many times, and I would agree with that statement. Mm-hmm. The Angels' inability over the last decade to make just one playoff appearance while having two of the best players of all time, I guess over the last half decade, Ohtani and Trout, is maybe the most embarrassing roster building flub in baseball history. Mm-hmm. However, I see the end of an era hurtling towards us, Jordan, where the Angels in a year, 2 years, 3 years from now may look completely different and may have a totally different ethos and vibe and construction. And because of that, this year, I am removing my Angels hater tag. Hmm. I want these fans and this team to experience one final fling of joy. I know we don't want to talk about the future. Ohtani is freaking gone. I think he's gone. And because of that, this is a last summer fling. This is a chance for one shot at love. And I hope that Ohtani can put the Angels on his back and help take them to the playoffs. And part of the reason I'm more hopeful is because the supporting cast in 2023 on the offensive side has been light years better than anything we've seen recently from the Angels. Mickey Moniak, Brandon Drury.
Drury's been really good. Yep.
Taylor Ward has had his moments. Logan Ohapi, I know he has been hurt for a while, but when he, if he gets back, like that's another real piece. I think this Angels team is much deeper than it's been in previous seasons. The pitching, I still have a lot of concerns with. It's just not been as good as we thought it was going to be. But
that's, yeah. And that's what I think a lot of people were more optimistic about, was like, look at this young rotation. And now we add Tyler Anderson. And it's like, sorry, like there's still elements of this roster building that I have no confidence in. But again, it's enough. It is good enough. They've played good enough. And the top end with Ohtani is still good enough that they should be in the mix for a wild card spot.
At this point in previous seasons, to me, the narrative was the Angels cannot make the playoffs. This year they can. Doesn't mean they will. Mm-hmm. They could easily lose out on a spot. But the team is there to do it. And that is not something I believed in past years. That is a credit to Mike Trout. That is a credit to Shohei Ohtani, to Perry Minasian, their general manager, and honestly, to their coach, Phil Nevin, who has kept this thing moving forward.
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, a very simple way to look at it, and I look at this often on for really good teams and whatever, as far as consistency, they don't have longer than a 3-game losing streak this year. And like that is something that the Angels normally have a week where it just the whole season goes in the toilet. And they haven't had that. They haven't allowed that to happen. And that's, you know, credit to them. So again, still a lot of work to do, still a flawed roster. But when you have, it's again, you just have to get it to sufficient when you have the best baseball player who's ever freaking lived. So
exactly.
that's where we're at with them.
Two more topics before we go and take a break and talk about some fish. We spend a whole lot of time on this show talking about surprises and disappointments, about teams that are overperforming or underperforming, celebrating those who are surpassing expectations and cackling at those who are not living up to them. But I want to talk about the predictable teams. Jordan, which clubs around the league are exactly who we thought they were?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, easy way to do this, and you know, I have a sheet that just has the preseason Fangraphs projected win totals and Pecota projected win totals, and you know, the Vegas over unders. And it's interesting because when you sort them by, you know, who was projected to be the most wins, there's really only one team at the top that has actually delivered fully, and that is Atlanta. No one, again, the other teams that were easily projected for the most wins, the Mets, disaster, Padres, disaster, Yankees, not bad, but are they going to definitely win 92 games? Maybe. I'm not super, you know, Pecota had them at 96. I certainly would take the under on that. Astros, clearly underwhelming. Dodgers, I mean, they were projected for a lot less than we expected. I actually think that the Dodgers might be an answer here too, weirdly, because of the concerns we had about the roster. They're clearly still a good team. I'm surprised where they are in the standings, but I think the win total that they're headed for is actually not that surprising based on the concerns that we had and some of the issues that we've seen with them. I think Toronto weirdly also fits in the category of maybe on, but maybe you'd say they're a little bit more towards disappointing.
I would say the fact that their opening day starter, who is one of the best pitchers in the world last year, just gave up 11 runs. In the complex
to 18-year-olds? Yeah, okay. Yeah. That's fair. So then other than that, I mean, I don't know. I guess Milwaukee has been pretty much as expected, maybe a little bit worse. Who else kind of stands out for you as at the bottom? I mean, Colorado, you know, Oakland. The Nats have really started to look a lot more recently like we expected.
So that's what's interesting. The bottom is what we thought the bottom would be. Mm-hmm. The last place team.
Except for the Reds.
In every single division except the NL Central is who we would have predicted. Boston, Kansas City, Oakland, DC, and Colorado. Those are the cellar dwellers, and we thought they would be the cellar dwellers. The cellar dwellers. Come on, Jake. The Cardinals are obviously the big one that stands out. But yeah, dude, I would say the Phillies are probably where I thought they would be as they start to right the ship a little bit. They're at 41-37, 3 games back in the wild card. Where they were last year, flawed team with a lot of really good players on it. But it is a reminder that this season has been weird and unpredictable and an outlier, I would say, and even a turning point. I think there's a chance we look back on this season in a couple years and we see the Astros didn't make the playoffs, or the Yankees didn't make the playoffs, or the Dodgers didn't make the playoffs. And it's, oh, this was a different outcome, a different result than what we had grown accustomed to.
Yeah, and I think that there's and we'll see how many of these teams can hang on. Of course, we're about to talk about them. Miami near the top of that list of is this team really heading to a legitimate, not 2020 Jesus Aguilar smoking cigars postseason berth. But you know, Arizona too, right? San Francisco, like these are teams too. Cincinnati, of course, and near the top because Cincinnati is the one that in terms of how much they're beating their projections, you know, most of the projections had Arizona and even Miami as average teams. They did not look at them and said, these teams stink. It was just like we, especially with Miami, there was really never, they did not give enough to make us really believe in the track record was there. And we'll talk about that with Daniel. Giants even too, right? And Angels, right? Like these are teams that we all had in the middle. And there's even the Rangers, versions where it could go well. Whereas Cincinnati, everyone's like, they still suck. And are they going to finish in first place? I don't know, but I don't think they suck.
We call these teams 71 or 91.
Yeah.
They could end up with 71 wins or 91 wins. And the Reds were not that. The Reds were 61 wins. And here they are wowing us at every turn. But I want to hop back to the Braves for our last topic before the break. The Braves have lived up to the hype and even more than that, Ronald Acuña Jr. is incredible. Jordan, you wrote about him this week over at Fox Sports, how his quest for 40-40 is very much on track, how he returned from injury, a better version of himself. What has impressed you most about Acuña this season?
Well, it's that we're not talking about 40-40, we're talking about 40-70, which of course has never happened before. 30-70 has never happened before. The closest we've seen that was, I believe, Eric Davis went 28 and 72 or something. But Ronald is on a mission to a degree that is so incredible to watch. And I think we have seen, like, we knew that he could be the best non-Otani player in baseball. Again, the preface of this conversation, like, I want to move Otani aside, right? We're talking about the best players in baseball that are not the most amazing thing we've ever seen. And Ronald Acuña is absolutely in that conversation. I think I was struck, you know, getting to talk to him, talk to some of his teammates and think about the fact that, you know, I harped on how I got to talk to him in Cincinnati and that's where it all started, you know, just 5 years ago. But it feels like him and Soto fits in this category too. They've just been in our lives for so long. They've just been such an important part of this generation. And because both of those guys kind of came before that next wave of Vlad and Tatis and then, you know, Wander and so on and so forth, the guys who have debuted super duper young, he really does just stand out as someone who we've seen so much of. And we've talked about him so much and we've seen the ups and downs on and off the field. And talking to people, talking to him and talking to people around him and honestly talking to Daniel Alvarez, who we're going to have here in a second, as he knows him as well as anybody, as our main, you know, Venezuelan baseball plug. I think everything that happened with him this offseason, a lot of drama involving the Winter League and playing at home and playing for the WBC team, where at one point it wasn't going to look like he was actually going to play with them, and how he was being received. It seemed like that whole experience kind of snapped into a place where I am now healthy. I know I can be the best player in the league. And everybody knows I can be the best player in the league. And they want me to be the best player in the league. And I have to go do that. And anything else that is going to distract from that is not worth it. And it helps to be on, you know, one of, if maybe not the best team in baseball, where he has so much support. It's not all on him. He can just play freely, play his game. No one's going to get mad about it. But my God, like, he is my favorite thing about it from the stolen base standpoint is, again, there are other fast players in the league. Not everyone wants to run like him. And this is part of what makes Ellie special also, but you got to have that drive and that motivation, that fearlessness, that ambition, and the green light from your team to just go, 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 go. And it is an incredible combination when you also see what he can do on offense, which is a whole other part of the conversation, which is just shocking that he has just completely stopped striking out in a way that you just do not see players figure out how to do year over year.
I also want to emphasize how young this guy still is. Mm-hmm. Ronald Acuña was born December 18th, 1997. Okay. Spencer Steer, who has been one of the more impressive rookies in the league this season for the Cincinnati Reds. He has produced 1.6 WAR this year as a rookie. Wow. Spencer Steer is 2 weeks older than Ronald Acuña Jr. who has been in the big leagues for a half decade and has a career 902 OPS. Mm-hmm. Career 902 OPS. Ronald Acuna Jr. is younger than Stephen Kwan, Jeremy Pena, Austin Riley, Luis Robert Jr.
Poor, younger than Austin Riley is great because Austin Riley came up so young and still is still. Also, again, think about that too. With Riley and the struggles he's had this year, we thought he was figuring it all out. It's like, oh, he's going through struggles. And what Acuna did last year when he was clearly not healthy, right? He was healthy enough to play, but everyone around the team, and he would admit too, I was not at my best. I did right. not feel like I could be Ronald Acuna Jr. And he still went nearly 15-30 and was an above average hitter and at times looked like one of the best players in baseball. And so now it's like full go. Here we go, right? He was born on the same day as Brandon Marsh. Yep. Literally exact same age as Brandon Marsh. Think about how long it took Brandon Marsh to figure it out. And he's still sort of putting it together. I know he had a big game last night. It's just astonishing. And we should, like, he is another one where, like, we could be watching. I know this sounds insane, but I've had conversations with Daniel that make me think it's not insane. He could be the greatest Venezuelan baseball player of all time. Miguel Cabrera, of course, the career is unmatched. And it'll take so long for him to get to those numbers. But he currently has basically the same OPS that Miggy has over his career. And he's going to steal 80 freaking bases this year. So I just, there's nothing stopping this guy and the drive with which he's taking going forward. And because he's so enabled being on such a great Braves team, it's the perfect storm to have what's going to be, I think, an MVP season.
And he's on pace for all these incredible numbers career-wise. Remember, 2020 was a half a season in which he was incredible. Yeah. And then his leg went kablooey and missed, you know, parts of two seasons. Mm-hmm. And he's still almost halfway to 300 home runs and 300 stolen bases,
yeah.
which would make him, if he does get there, only the ninth player all time to accomplish that.
And again, he could very easily get to 150, 150 after this year. And I had this in my story. The only other two guys that have done that through age 25 are Mike Trout and A-Rod. And they did it in over 900 games. And Acuna is going to have less than 700. So it's absurd. And I don't want to take him for granted either. And I know the Braves are so good and they have so many great players that, you know, maybe he doesn't. But it's just, it's so cool. And I'm so happy for him. And I'm glad that he's now back atop the kind of clear, you know, pantheon of best players in the world.
All righty. Let's take a quick break. And when we return, we will go out to the ocean with a reel, some bait, and a box of ice and talk about fish.
This is former PGA Tour winner Smiley Kaufman, host of The Smiley Show, a SiriusXM podcast. You want to know what I love about golf? I get to talk to some really cool people. I get to walk the fairways of the best courses in the world with the best players in the world, and I get to share it with you every single week. Listen to The Smiley Show right now on Stitcher, Pandora, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Smiley, S-M-Y-L-I-E.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We are now very excited to be joined by one of our good friends and a recurring guest, our Marlins correspondent, our Venezuelan baseball expert. It is Daniel Alvarez. Daniel, welcome back to the show, my friend.
Thank you, Jordan. Thank you, Jake. It's a pleasure, an honor, and always great to talk with you guys.
Oh, my heart is full. Jordan, they say you shouldn't heat up fish in the microwave. They say that's rude. But the Miami Marlins are ignoring those rules because the fish are hot.
Hot fish after a 10-1 drubbing of the Boston Red Sox last night. The Marlins are almost to a positive run differential. We'll get to that in a little bit. But hey, there is a lot of good things happening. And I think the best way to kind of summarize how good the Marlins have been is that before Daniel came on, we just did a whole Ronald Acuna discussion without him, even though he would have been a great guest for that. But we're keeping Daniel focused on the mighty Marlins here because they're 46-34. At the end of June, they are in second place comfortably. They are in great position to make a wild card spot. People are going to Marlins Park to watch this team. And let's just keep it simple, Daniel. What has surprised you about this incredible Marlins start? And what has it been like watching this team be legitimately good for multiple months in a row?
It's been great. It's been fun. It has made my job a lot easier because it's, you know, it's way better when you go to the ballpark and you know that you can cover a team that can actually win many games. And I think that the best part of it and what has surprised me the most is that they have 22 wins coming from behind. So this is a resilient team, something that it was tough to see, especially last year or the last couple of years. And I think I have to give a lot of credit to the coaching staffs, Kip Schumacher, obviously. But this team, I mean, so many guys have took a step forward, especially the guys from the bullpen, keeping the game so close. This team has won so many one-run games all season long, and there's a lot of credit that goes to the bullpen arms, but their resiliency too. And that's something that I really have to point out because it's been really good this year.
So you mentioned Skip Schumacher, who is the first-year manager of the Miami Marlins. Don Mattingly was the head man from 2016 to 2022. That is 8 seasons. He was one of the longest-tenured managers before he left. Is it fair to say that in the last couple years of Mattingly, things grew stale a little bit in the clubhouse? Is Skip Schumacher providing a new voice for the team? Because Jordan and I, when we talk about managers, we have no idea how to talk about managers. We have no idea what kind of impact they have. We can never measure it. It definitely exists. So how important has Skip Schumacher been to this enterprise?
He's been so important with, as you mentioned, a new voice, fresh voice, a new message. Someone, for example, and Donnie mentioned this the last day of the season last year, someone that Kim chose to manage the team, because Donnie was there when Kim Ang got to the team as a general manager. So now she's building exactly what she wanted. And that's something that Donnie told me last week when the Blue Jays were in town. And he's so proud to see what the guys are doing. He always felt that this was possible, but he knew that they needed a new voice. Obviously, it wasn't only Mattingly. Plenty of guys left the team from last year. Obviously, Miguel Rojas is one of the main guys that was traded to the Dodgers again. But also Aguilar, Pablo, Anthony Bass was traded mid-season last year. Zach Pop was traded mid-season last year. So plenty of changes that led to this. And now with a new voice in Skip, but also in the clubhouse, with a younger team that is having more fun than probably any other team in the league. And I don't know if you guys saw last night a video in the clubhouse of Sandy talking to the guy saying, hey, I've been here since 2018 and I've never seen something quite like it. And I have to agree with Sandy because we basically started in the Marlins, him as a player and me as a reporter in the same year.
Right. And that's a great way to kind of set up my next question, because to your point, like, and by the way, for those who know, like, Daniel, you're not technically a Marlins beat writer, but that is your home park, and you know this team. Correct. And as we're going to get to with guys like Arise, like Sandy, like Yuri Perez, you know these guys as well as anybody. And so you are more than qualified to talk about this. 17-7 in June. They're 19-5 in one-run games, which has a lot to do with how they're this good, still with a -6 run differential. But we mentioned, yes, okay, sure, Mattingly maybe wasn't pushing them forward anymore, and so Skip has a big difference. We got to talk about the players here. We got to talk about the performances that we're getting. And that's what I really want to hear from you is Arise is going to be his own conversation. We're going to save that. But besides him, what has, because you mentioned Sandy, he hasn't been great. You know, last night we saw him finally start to look good, right? Yeah. Last night was really the first time it was like, oh, there's Cy Sandy again. Go ahead,
if Jake. I said to you before the season, Daniel, Joey Wendell is going to be meh. Gene Segura is going to suck. Jazz is going to be hurt for a while. Sandy is going to be underwhelming. Edward Cabrera is going to be hurt. And the bullpen's going to be sufficient but not dominant. How good will this team be? You would have said, not that good. And yet here they are 12 games over 500, right?
I would have said it's the same photo of 21 and 22 and that's it. And we're just getting ready to have a busy deadline, trading players and basically rebuilding again, right? But no, there's a lot of credit that goes to them. As you mentioned, of course, Arraez is on a whole different discussion. But players like Andrew Nardi, like Tanner Scott, yes, the bullpen, as you mentioned, hasn't been dominant. But they've been really solid AJ Puck, who was a late offseason trade with the A's in exchange for JJ Bleday, and has paid out very, very well for the Marlins. That's something that has really impressed me, how good the bullpen has been. I have my concerns because they're pitching basically every single night, and by the time we hit July or August, they're going to be tired, and that's going to change things a lot. But they've been so good so far. And also, Yuli Gurriel was a late signing, but Yuli has been so good to this ball club since day one. And I remember talking to Yuli in spring training, late spring training, when WBC was done and for the first couple of weeks of the season. And Yuli has been saying since day one, since he got there, we're going to play in October. We're going to play in October. Hey, this team has everything to play in October. And maybe it's Yuli just motivating them, but Yuli's a winner. We know how much he won with the Astros since he got to the States. So I'm really confident that this team can make a fun run until the end. I don't know for how long. I don't know if it's going to be the playoffs, but they're going to be fun. And I think that these guys that took a step forward and these new leaders of the team have really helped a lot.
It seems cliche, but that's why you signed Yuli Gurriel. He doesn't even know what it's like to be on a losing team. He doesn't know any better. Right?
No, and we can't even say that this is a losing team, because as of now, the Marlins are in the playoffs and the Astros are not.
No, they're not. Exactly. But even in spring training, to your point, like, he's like, I'm here. Like, I know what a winning team looks like. I can look at this roster and say, you know what? This team's good enough. I can help this team. And of course, we've heard stories like that before, and it doesn't always go as well as this is going. But I do think that there's some credence to that. I think, too, like, Soler is another one who I think is a massive part of this season. Yeah. And while, you know, unfortunately, I know, I'm sure it hurts you as a Venezuelan baseball expert and native, the Avisal Garcia part has not gone as well in year two for a lot of reasons. But when we looked at those signings and we said, like, Soler, it was just like, he was just hurt, you know?
He was just hurt.
And man, that's when that guy is going.
That was a frustrating part last year, that when Soler got hurt, he got hurt. And same with Abisail this year. Mm-hmm. He was not on a tear, but he was doing really good when he got hurt. And it's basically the same injury Soler had last season. So we know he's going to be out for a while. But with Soler, he's healthy. And he's confident, and that's something that we didn't see last year, and it's a whole different guy compared to 2022, and he's a good presence too, and he can change the whole game plan for a pitcher when he's in the lineup, because although he could be in a slump, he's one of the most powerful hitters in the game, and he can change everything with one swing. So he has done that plenty of times this year, and having him, also Brian De La Cruz and Jesus Sanchez playing on a good level, has helped that heart of the lineup, because they really needed that, especially when Jazz went down, because that's the other thing. This team had a negative record when Jazz got hurt. Jazz was was doing good offensively and defensively too. A lot of credit for him, because he has really converted himself into a solid center fielder. And this team somehow play way better without Jazz in the lineup than with Jazz in the lineup. And that's something that not too many people are seeing here.
So Jazz is now back. He was activated off the IL. He hurt his toe at the beginning of the season, missed about 5 or 6 weeks. Yesterday was his first game back. Jazz Chisholm Jr. is great. Jr. also sucks up a lot of air, attention, and focus wherever he goes. That is part of what makes him special. How will he reintegrate into this team that is succeeding so much? How much has he been around the clubhouse while they've been winning is one part of this question. And do you think that it will be, like, how easy will it be for him to hop right back in on this?
He's been around, especially the first couple of weeks he was around and doing treatment, but also being in the clubhouse and in the dugout with the guys. I saw him plenty of games in Miami and on the road as well with the team, just as I said, by having treatment with the trainers and medical staff of the team, but also but just supporting. And when he was in AAA in Jacksonville playing, he was always paying attention to what was going on in Miami. I know he wanted to play earlier, like 2 weeks ago, and they were like, Jess, there's no way you can play now. Like, this is just not going to happen. He needed some rehab games, and I think he's just going to be as impactful as he was last night. We saw him scoring on a hit that I personally thought, okay, he's going to be out at home. They're going to throw him out, but he wasn't, because he's so fast. He's so good at sliding at the bases or at the plate, although it might look dangerous sometimes because it's too hard. But he's a game changer, and he's the spark of this team with Arraez, of course. But he's just going to be way impactful in so many ways, and I think it's so good to have him back.
Because going into the year, it was like, okay, so how are the Marlins going to be good? Well, they're going to steal a lot of bases. Yeah. They are 19th in the big leagues in steals. That's not how they've done this. And part of that is because Jazz has been out, so hopefully he can bump that number up and they can steal more bags. Jordan, I know you want to ask about Luis Arraez. I know you're jumping at the bit to do that, so why don't we get that out of the way?
Well, I think I want to finish with Arraez. We got to talk about Yuri Perez. I know we have mentioned him, and we talked about him more on recent episodes, but he's, I think, besides Arraez, the top story of the season, especially because Sandy has underwhelmed, and as great as Soler has been, a little bit more of a known quantity. So I mean, take it wherever you want. Like, I don't know how long you, as you mentioned, you've been around the Marlins. So, you know, I'm curious when you first started hearing about Yuri, talk about his relationship with Sandy, but what it's been like watching him succeed like this up close. And yeah, take it wherever you want.
Well, I first knew about Yuri when he signed in 2019, that he was a good pitching prospect. And then all of a sudden, pandemic year came. And he appeared in 2021 having a monster season. And I met him personally that last year of last day of the season, because they brought him to Miami, and they gave him an award. I think it was like a pitcher of the year or something like that. And I see this 6'7", 18-year-old kid, and I'm like, what is this? Like, what is this? Like, and he... The thing that really surprised me was how nice he is. And he's one of the most genuine, humble, nicest kids I've ever been around. And the only thing I said is, dude, I hope he stays like this forever. And then the next year, he went to the Futures game in Los Angeles. And I talked to him there. I talked to him in spring training months before. And I'm like, okay, I'm very excited to see this kid, because he not only he's really good, but he's such a nice person. And now we see him that he's only 20. He can't legally drink. If the Marlins make the postseason, he's just not allowed to drink. just think about that. But the way he dominates on the mound, it's like, dude, you have a baby face, although you're like 6'7", 6'8", but you're just throwing 99 with a nasty changeup, nasty slider, and just allowing one run in the whole month of June. So think about that. And the Marlins have I think it's a good problem to have, because at some point they will have to stop him. I don't know how, if it's sending him down or just giving him a break, because he already passed his career high in innings at any level in professional baseball. So that's a problem, because he's only 20, and they have to protect that arm. And he's right now, he's the best pitcher in the team. And that's hands down like that, because you see the numbers and compared to what all the guys are doing, and everybody has been the best.
That's an amazing point that I was sort of on my radar in terms of workload. And you hear about this with other young pitchers, and I think a lot of different teams have different philosophies on it, but it's a great point. I mean, he threw 78 innings in 21, 77 innings last year, and now he's at 78 innings this year between Double A and the big leagues. And we're not even to July. He's clearly their most important. I mean, maybe already their best pitcher. We'll see, most important. Now, this is where it's nice to know that Sandy is going to go out there and give you 7 and 8 every time. Like, this is where it's good to kind of have those guys. But they've had some other injuries, and this is where you kind of get worried. But as you still mentioned, it's still a good problem to have. What an unbelievable talent. He is must watch, and I'm excited to see him. I imagine Friday is his next start.
Friday in Atlanta.
Great.
I think it's going to be his biggest challenge yet.
Easily. Yeah.
Easily, because against the best team in the National League and probably in baseball, but I'm excited to see him.
All right. Let's talk Luis Arraez.
La regadera.
When this trade happens, two of the best Venezuelan players in the league getting traded for each other, and as you know, two of also the nicest people, and you've known both of them. We'll skip past rehashing the trade and everything. I do know that you've known Luis Arraez for a long time. So while the national audience is really getting to know him this year as he's, you know, trying to bat 400 or whatever, if he bats 380, it's unbelievable. When did you know Luis Arraez was special? Because I know it was probably before most of us.
When he played in the Venezuelan Winter League in 2016.
16, okay.
Because he led the league in batting average, and he was just 19. Mm-hmm. And already making a big splash with Magallanes, who, as you know, it's one of the most important teams in the Caribbean. And he was playing games against Caracas, in Caracas or in Valencia, and having great, great games with a lot of pressure, because there's pressure in winter ball at any time of the season. And he just dominated the league at 19. And I'm like, okay, yeah, maybe Venezuela doesn't have the best pitching in the Caribbean, but I don't care. He's just 19 and he's just dominating and being the best hitter, one of the best hitters in the Caribbean this year. So he has the chance to be special. And then he made his way to single A, double A. And when I saw him for the first time personally in spring training of 2019, working with Rod Carew in Fort Myers, I saw his routine, how focused he was and how determined he was to make it to the big leagues that year. And he said, yes, I really believe that I can make it this year. And within 2 months, he was already playing with the Twins in at the biggest level. So I was fortunate to see him from afar in 2016 when he was playing that well with Magallanes. And that's what I'm not surprised of what he's doing. Of course, when I see him hitting over 400, of course I'm surprised, and I'm like, dude, how could you be doing this in almost July? Like, this doesn't happen ever. So why are you doing it? And it's been a privilege to follow him and see him work every single day.
Does he think he can hit 400? Is he thinking about it?
He's thinking about it. He's thinking about it. I ask him that. I think the first time he got over 400 in this month, and I asked him, like, hey, when you see the number on the scoreboard and you see 401 or 402, what goes through your mind? He says that it's actually possible for me to hit 400. And I'm like, do you believe you can hit 400? He's like, yeah, it's possible, and I believe I can do it.
Which is amazing. We had a conversation 3 or 4 weeks ago when he went 0-for in Seattle, and we were talking about how impossible the math is. Like, you have a few bad games and you're like, well, we're screwed. All right, you're not hitting 400 anymore. And then he proceeded to have, I think, 2 5-hit games in the span of like 4 days.
He's back.
He's back. You
know, going back to Jake's question, this was day two of the season. I didn't cover opening day for the Marlins because I was in Tampa watching the Tigers and Miggy's final opening day, Miggy Cabrera. And then I drove back to Miami the next morning, and he had, I think it was like a 3-hit game against the Mets day two of the season. And we're talking, this is just off the record, but I can share it with you. And Luis told me right to my face, listen, I'm going to win the batting title this year, and we're going to do something about it at the end of the year. I want you to come with me and see everything I'm doing in the offseason once I win the batting title again. And I'm like, dude, it's day two. He's like, yeah, but I'm winning this thing again. I'm like, okay, yeah, I believe you. And now he's dominating that.
He won in the AL last year and is now obviously, I don't even know what would – he could probably go, 0-for-30 and still be the favorite to win it this year. It's not just the average. I mean, the dude's on pace for like nearly 250 hits.
Yeah.
Like we're like, that's the thing I'm really watching too, is just how many hits he can actually stack up. I mean, he's incredible. And I'm yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that one thing that I want to point out here is that people that are not seeing him and that are not watching Marlins game, and now it's a good time to watch them for many reasons that we just mentioned. But if you just read the numbers or you go to the Savan page and you see that he's not hitting the ball hard according to the metrics, or that he just hits singles, they're wrong, because this guy is just hitting balls hard. Because yeah, even though it says, oh, hard hit, it's 95 small per hour plus. Well, but if you hit it 94, that's pretty hard enough, you know? And just to see the bat to ball skills, the hand eye coordination, and the way he's hitting the ball, driving it to the other way, I think he takes it personal when he sees that someone's shifting him on the way they can, and he sees a defender moving a bit to right or left. I think he takes it personal. He's like, you're shifting me, really? And then he goes and hit it whatever they're not placed. So I think that's the most impressive part, that he knows he can hit for more power. We saw him WBC what he did against Lance Lynn and Team USA. He knows he can do it, but he just doesn't need to, because the big guys are behind him, Soler, De La Cruz, Jazz, the guys that we just mentioned, to do that job. And he's just changing the way this Marlins lineup was functioning for years, and it's been so good for them.
Yeah, if you're looking at the underlying metrics and want to rely on that, then I just feel sad for you, honestly, at this point. last question for you, Daniel, before we let you go, because we know not everyone's necessarily, you know, locked into the Marlins, but I want to know what the reception's been actually in Miami, because I was talking to you a little bit yesterday about this, but it sounds like it's picking up, right? Maybe it's not automatic sellout the way it's been in some other markets that have been suddenly had a good team like Cincinnati and whatever, but it seems like we actually are making steps in the right direction. So how have you kind of felt that, and what does that look like?
Yeah, I agree. And I think there's not a coincidence that it's happening just when both the Miami Heat season and Florida Panthers season, it's done. They both went to their championship round or finals, whatever. They both lost, unfortunately. But now that those two seasons are over, people are coming to the ballpark because the team is winning. And that's the important part. To see 25,000 on Saturday against the Pirates and 22,000 on Sunday against the same team, something that I could have never imagined years ago to see, you know, because that's usually was at 9,000, 10,000, if lucky, you know, attendance against a Pirates team. So to see it live and to see the excitement of the people, the MVP chance for Luis, or the age, people turning on the lights on the phone when AJ Puck comes in and the whole ballpark gets dark, just like they do in Houston with Presley or Edwin Diaz in New York. I mean, I feel like it's kind of starting to create a culture among Marlins fans, and that's pretty exciting to see.
And like, I think the Heat Panther thing is a good point, because oftentimes, by the time you get to the end of the June, the Marlins are already toast. And so it's like, once
exactly that happened, that has happened for the last couple of years. And to see that they're actually winning, it's like, hey, let's keep this going, because teams in South Florida are doing pretty good.
Right.
The Dolphins might be good this year. Mm-hmm. Messi's coming to town.
Hey.
We have F1 here in Miami. So many, many good things are happening in South Florida sports. And to actually see the Marlins doing this good, I think it's pretty exciting, and it's contagious as well.
Last question. Does Messi throw out a first pitch at Marlins Park?
I hope he does. And you know what? If he does it, he's going to throw it as a right-hander, because I didn't know he was a righty. He just kicks with his left leg. But he's a right. He's actually a righty.
Real question, and I'm sure we will review his first pitch when it happens, who's going to catch it? Because, you know, for normal first pitches, where it's just whoever, they'll just throw out the last reliever. Like nobody wants to go do that, right?
Yeah.
But I imagine it will be different in this case. So who do you think? Who's your pick?
I think it could be Yuli Gurriel because he's the biggest soccer fan in that clubhouse.
That's a good
point. It's funny because the Mariners recorded a video with a Messi jersey saying him like, hey, welcome to Miami, whatever. And Luis was like, hey, Messi, my brother. Like, if they're like their best friends, I'm like, yeah.
You don't know him.
You don't know him. It's like, hey, Messi, my brother. I'm like, no, you don't know him, but you're from Jaracu. You never watch a soccer game down there. But,
well,
Yuli is a huge soccer guy. Although he's a big Real Madrid fan, ooh, I think Yuli and Soler might be fighting each other.
I like the idea of Sandy being like, I'm the most important guy on the team. Even though I'm pitching today, I'm catching.
I'm catching Sandy.
Yeah, well, that will be among the many reasons to watch the Marlins in the second half. Will Messi throw out a first pitch? Daniel Alvarez, you are incredible at what you do. We are so lucky to have you as a regular guest on the show. Thank you so much for the insight. And come on, Marlins, make us proud. We appreciate it.
that's a good song. I got it. I'm always happy to be here, and I can't wait to see you guys in Seattle in a week and 2 days from now.
We'll,
I guess
we'll see you and Luis Arraez there. It will be a good time. All right, thank absolutely. You, Daniel.
Thank you, guys.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Thank you to Daniel Alvarez, as always, for being incredibly good at his job and a very nice man with a lot of good baseball insight. We are going to do, instead of doing bold predictions, maybe we'll save that for Friday. I'll look at those later this week. We wanted to do a quick email before we get out of here. You can email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. And we received a fantastic email from Mark a little over a week ago. And I wanted to read it. Mark says, hey, Jake and Jordan, I want to share with you one of my favorite places on the internet right now. Cutter Crawford's Baseball Savant page. What? A great name for a pitcher, of course. Probably one of the only players of baseball that will appear in Google Images just by searching their first name. It was inevitable that someone named Cutter who enjoys baseball would eventually learn to throw a cutter. But I was curious how good his cutter actually is. And basically, I won't go into the nitty-gritty of the numbers, but basically, Cutter Crawford's cutter sucks. And when he wrote this email a little over a week and a half ago, Cutter Crawford had yet to record a single strikeout on a cutter. Now, you might say cutters aren't meant to get strikeouts, but he throws 30% cutters and has been pretty good this season and had yet to record a strikeout on a cutter until he faced the Twins and finally got one against Alex Kirilloff. And so Mark goes on, maybe there's been some bad luck given the .287 expected batting average, but I have to wonder, does Cutter Crawford feel like he has to throw a cutter because of his name? Do you think whoever named him Cutter is actively aware that this cutter has not been a good pitch for him this season as he considered changing his name to Curveball with a K? Crawford, thanks, guys. Love the pod. Jake, what do you make of this situation? I think it is hilarious. First of all, if anything, it let me know that Cutter Crawford's been pretty damn good for the Red Sox this year. But what do you make of this?
If Cutter Crawford's first name wasn't Cutter, he wouldn't throw one.
You're 100% certain of that?
Yeah, I feel like if he didn't have that name, he would have scrapped the pitch a while ago. But it is literally a part of him. What's he supposed to do, not throw a cutter anymore?
Well, this is great because this is also one of those things where Cutter Crawford, like when you name your kid Cutter, you know, you're at least hoping he's going to not end up as like a mailman, probably, right? But I don't know. I don't know how much what the baseball bloodlines are in the Crawford family, but I'm also curious about that. But yeah, I mean, I love it. I mean, I think he's thrown it since he's been in the big leagues. I'm curious if it, like the usage has ticked up in recent years, but it is quite hilarious. And you know, we've seen other cutters in baseball before, not with a K before, of course, but we have some cutters in the minors. Cutter Coffee, although I believe he's a shortstop. So I don't know. I also with the Red Sox, weirdly. But I don't know. This is you probably don't have the heart to tell him, like, hey dude, you can't throw this anymore. And the fact that he's throwing it 30% of the time, he's not gonna be able to just completely go cold turkey. He'd have to completely reinvent his repertoire.
Yeah, I think it doesn't matter. I would go the full I would go all the way to the other side, never throw it again. Just change your, just, you can be like, you know, location Crawford or poison the mound Crawford.
Yeah, curveball Crawford is funny, but I don't know if, and that's, it certainly works better with the K. I wanted to look at it against the White Sox, how the cutter was, but I agree. I feel like he's got, I actually think he goes in the other direction. I think he should throw it exclusively. It does seem like he threw it less against the White Sox and maybe had more success.
Or he could be more, you know, factually accurate and be cutter Crawford with no K as he is.
That would also, right. That would also be a good point. Maybe it's a totally different pitch. And yeah, the cutter that we are watching him throw actually has nothing to do with it. That's a good point. So Cutter Crawford, let us know. Thank you to Mark for the wonderful email. Thank you to Daniel Alvarez for joining us. Thank you to Chris Tyler, as always, for producing. We will be back on Friday with possibly a fun special guest. We'll see, and we'll get to those bold predictions and review those from MLB.com later on this week. But until then, go listen to Marlins Will Soar 100 times. And we will talk to you in a couple of days.
Bye.
SiriusXM Podcasts.